you could say, on what we should do. So I've scoured clip art for all the pictures of forks available, and they will see if you can, it's kind of like Where's Waldo, this is Spot the Fork. So anyways, our first dilemma, I guess, is the first fork that we come to in the road. You notice fork right in the middle there. If the problem is single-parent families, children in single-parent families have a higher rate of poverty or low income than do children in two-parent families, how can we solve that? Well, one way would be to cut down on the number of single-parent families. The other way would be to somehow get single-parent families more income. So I'm going to first talk about a marital. So this is our fork. We've got a marital solution and a fiscal solution. The marital solution is that marriage is a powerful poverty fighter. We've heard a lot of the benefits of marriage so far today. If you're an adult aged 18 to 64, your odds of being in low income fall from 30% or so to about 6.4% the day you get married, which isn't a bad wedding gift. We've already seen all those statistics there. Marriage is a poverty fighter. But what can a government do to promote marriage? We've heard a lot of some discussion, particularly David during the luncheon discussion, about there should be some government recognition of the benefits of marriage. Well, the only example you can find of explicit, very explicit, not fertility promotion, but marriage promotion anywhere in the world really has been the Bush administration's Healthy Marriages Initiative. They just have allocated $500 million over 5 years for this. There's another $250 million over 5 years for what they call responsible fatherhood. This was money in the 2005 budget. It didn't get allocated till 2006. It is just those grants have just been given out now. Mainly, it's been given as grants to states and municipalities that apply. Most of the money is being given to one of two things. Advertising. If you drive around in the States, you'll see some billboards that say married people are wealthier, married people are happier, a lot of the things we heard from Jennifer earlier today, married people have more sex, etc., etc., just trying to instill in people's minds the benefits of marriage, kind of branding marriage as a good thing. The other is couples counseling. David Blankenhorn talked a little bit about one potential, which was divorce counseling, people that were applying for a divorce and then be getting funneled over into some sort of counseling. Most of the grants have been given to counseling that's streamed through the prenatal courses that are given. These are unmarried couples that come and the woman is pregnant, and they say, well, maybe you'd be interested in hearing about the benefits of marriage. It also tries to build some skills in terms of conflict resolution and handling family finances, the kinds of things that church sort of marriage courses used to do, although they're fine-tuning them for to be aimed at more of a low-income target audience. I think this is all very interesting. The unfortunate thing is it's all very new as well. I phoned the government, I phoned some academics in the States. The money having been given out in 2006, there's no evidence on whether any of this works, what works better than anything else. During the lunch speak, David was talking, he's saying this is just an idea they have in Georgia. And I wanted my talk to be as practical and policy-oriented as possible, so I'm just going to have to leave this fork right now and just say that it seems promising. It seems like an interesting thing to pursue. It's the marital fork, but I'm going to spend most of my time on the fiscal fork, which is how do we get more money into the single parent family. So before I do that, I'm just going to look at where am I now? Yes. So if we say that we want more money, we want to give more, we want single parent families to have more money, there's obviously two ways we can approach that. We can either give them the money, which is the welfare fork, or we can assist them in earning more money. So this is our welfare versus work dilemma for solving single parent family poverty. So first we do this. I'm just going to look quickly. We're going to learn some interesting lessons here at what has happened to single mothers' incomes. And again, you can see a fairly, this mirrors in some ways the participation rates, which isn't very surprising. But single mother income has gone up fairly significantly in the last 10 years. And why is that? Well, if we take a look at what's happened to single mothers' income, we can see 95 job earnings were about 20,000, money from government was about 10,000, they paid $3,300 in income tax, it gives you a total income of 26,900. 10 years later, job earnings have gone up $10,000, welfare and other transfers have come down a tiny bit, income taxes have gone up again. But the net benefit is a extra $10,000 in total income. And over this time, we've seen the poverty rate for single mothers come down by 20 percentage points. So this is a, I think this is a fairly strong argument in favor of pushing single mothers towards the work fork rather than saying we should be increasing welfare benefits for those single mothers. There's another study, I don't have a slide for it, but in the 1990s, the federal government looked at increases in welfare benefits. They found that for every $1,000 increase in welfare benefits, single mother job participation rates fell by about 2%. So obviously, remember that flat line we saw? Well, married mothers' work effort was going up, single mothers was flatlining. As welfare became more and more attractive, single mothers stopped working. But we've seen that it is the job market that improves the situation for single mothers much more so than it is government transfers. One final, just to hammer this nail in completely. OECD report on countries around the world found that the rate of poverty for a single parent family where that parent worked was about 20%, and where the parent didn't work was about 60%. So I think it's fairly convincing that if we want to fix single parent poverty, we want to have that single mother working. I'm not dismissing the role of government transfers. Clearly, they're a significant component. And when we talked about senior poverty, the government transfers like OAS and GIS and CPP have played a very big role there. And it's also the case that welfare is now much more targeted towards single mothers with much more specific benefits. But I think, by and large, we want to take the work fork when we're looking at how to improve single-parent poverty. So that brings us to another fork. This is the fork on the wall. This is the if we say we want single-parent families to enter the workforce, there's a couple of obstacles that they encounter. The first and most daunting one is what's called the welfare wall. I'm sure you're familiar with the concept. It's the idea that as you leave welfare, you leave behind a whole bunch of ancillary benefits as well as that check that you get. You're foregoing things like free child care, transportation subsidies, accommodation subsidies, drug and health and dental benefits, et cetera, all of which create disincentives for you to leave from welfare to go get a job. Just a graphical representation. This is really old, but it just shows you nicely the kind of castle-like shape of the marginal tax rate that a single mother would face. You know, there's kind of a moat there, and then you've got to scale that wall. This is your, do you really want to go out into the workforce? Do you want to earn that extra dollar? over and above what, you know, give up your welfare check and earn that extra dollar and move into the workforce. And you can see these are very big disincentives. You're going to climb that wall. At some point, you can draw these based on specific examples. You can get the marginal tax rate up to about 78%, depending on what your situation is, which means for every dollar you earn, you're losing almost 80 cents in lost benefits and taxes that you pay, et cetera, et cetera. So this is a pretty big disincentive for single mothers especially. And this no doubt explains a lot of the the flatlining of the single parent work effort through the 80s when welfare became quite attractive. So what can we do to get single mothers over the welfare wall? Well, we come to the fork that we're involved in right now, the fork on the wall. There's two ways, I would argue. You could have a market solution or a non-market incentive to get single mothers into the workforce. These are just a collection of, I'm not picking on Campaign 2000, but as I was there, I saw they had a nice typical example, I guess, of the kinds of policies that get demanded that would help single mothers in general. So these are things like higher minimum wages, free drug, dental, health, universal child care, affordable housing, tuition freeze, greater unionization, etc. I'm not going to go through each one of them one by one. Higher minimum wages isn't really going to draw too many single mothers into the workforce, I don't think. It might help some people that are already in the workforce. Tuition freezes tend to destroy universities for everybody. Don't really know what unionization has to do with anything. But universal child care is obviously an important thing. That was Patricia's topic. And it obviously creates another dilemma that if we want mothers to work, then we have to do something with their, the children have to go somewhere. Obviously, if it's a day job, they're going to have to any job, they're going to have to be in non-parental care at some point. I've done a lot of work on child care. I certainly don't think that universal child care is a solution here. It's been promoted in Quebec, for instance, but by and large, the biggest users of universal child care in Quebec are middle and upper class families, two-parent families. They like it very much, but it's very politically popular, but it's not really getting at our issue today. It's a very blunt instrument if you're worried about single-parent poverty to offer child care to everybody. It's also the case, Statistics Canada does other surveys on child care use, and most parents don't choose formal daycare. They choose all sorts of informal arrangements far more prevalently than they do formal arrangements. Just to leave child care and go on with the rest of the talk, I think that if we're concern on this issue should be based more on what the single mothers themselves would like, what sort of non-parental care they would like for their children. I know care by other relatives, grandparent care, that kind of stuff is very popular. Right now, the sorts of subsidies, though, that are targeted to single mothers don't permit them to pay their parents, etc. I think that's an area that should be explored. I think we do have to be cognizant that there's a child care issue there, but I think we can be much more sensitive to parental wishes by changing how we subsidize that child care. But I'm going to argue that it's the other fork, the market incentives, that hold the greatest promise for bringing single parents into the workforce and solving this particular form of poverty. Market incentives, I'm talking about a way that makes the parent more interested in entering the workforce rather than creating some structure of free child care or free tuition or changing the minimum wage, etc. A way of changing the motivation of the single parent. And the most successful market incentive, I think you'll find, has been the United States' Earned Income Tax Credit. This is a deliberate policy aimed at the welfare wall that says, we recognize that you face these disincentives, these large marginal tax rates, as you move from welfare to work. So we're going to offer you an extra cash incentive. It's paid through the tax system. If you are working and you are in low income, you get this extra amount of money from the government that compensates you for the high marginal tax rates. It's a very successful social policy in the U.S. 20% of all U.S. families receive something from it. Single mothers are the biggest demographic within the recipients of it, and it's been calculated that the U.S. poverty rate for children would be 25% higher without it. It has an interesting political history that's also worth thinking about, because I'm going to come to how this applies to Canada very shortly. It was invented in the Nixon administration about 30 years ago, but Bill Clinton greatly expanded it during his welfare reforms in the mid-90s. So what you have is both parties kind of think it's theirs, and it tends to have fairly strong bipartisan support. Some people have called it the safest $37 billion social program in the U.S., although it's certainly not immune to criticism. But it's generally regarded as very successful. There was some mention previously when Peter John introduced me about this evidence from the U.S. It's a Congressional Budget Office study that looked at the income distributions and how they'd fared since 1991. And it did show that the bottom fifth had made very strong gains, the second biggest gains of all the fifths, second only to the top group, which always do well. And the main driver behind that was the EITC. So it has been a big success. So what about Canada? My voice is holding out. Well, some provinces have small EITC-type programs, Saskatchewan, BC, Quebec. Manitoba just announced one in the spring. They're all fairly modest. It is also the case that Ottawa, I talked about the sort of bipartisan, both parties think it's theirs in the U.S. Federally in Canada, we've had discussions about bringing something like this in. The Martin government in their 2005 update suggested one. It was reaffirmed in the Harper government's most recent budget this past spring. We're going to get one. It is going to kick in for the 2007 tax year, which means that when you get your tax forms in the spring, it will start to be bringing some benefits to Canadians. But how does it compare with the American version? Well, it's quite a bit smaller. Ours is, I wish the names, there's no good acronym for these things. So the WITB is really small and the EITC is really big. In some ways that's just, so this is kind of another fork, I guess, is what people think about the current WITB that we're getting. Is it good to start small and everyone will see the benefits in the same way that the benefits of being quite manifest in the U.S.? On the other hand, we've got 30 years of pretty good data that shows how successful this is in moving people off welfare and into the workforce, which, as we've seen, seems to be the surest solution to single-parent poverty. So you can be of two minds on this. We're starting small, but we're going to ramp it up. Or you can say that it's starting small, and the risk is that it may stay small forever. I think it would have been nicer to see some commitment that it will continue to grow. This is something I think that if we all agree that this is a positive thing, it's up to organizations to kind of keep the pressure on to say that a $1,000 benefit that you get through a WITB is insufficient, and this is something that needs to be monitored, obviously. It's good that we're getting, again, it's a good news. It's nice to see that we've made this progress, although it probably needs to be considerably bigger than it is right now. The final fork is a topic that it's not directly related to the pressing issue of poverty, I guess, in terms of how do we get single-parent families or poor families more money. But I think this is a very interesting, a very promising avenue, and it's the notion of asset building among low-income families. So one of the problems with welfare is that there's some strict asset restrictions on it. You can't have a car worth more than a certain value if you're receiving welfare in all the provinces. All the provinces put limits on how much liquid assets you can have. In Ontario, I think it's about $1,400 in a bank account, etc. The reason for this is obvious. You don't want to read in the paper that somebody getting welfare is driving around in a Cadillac and going to Florida for the winter time. But it also means that for legitimately low-income families, they basically are making do without any assets, without the ability to build assets, and they're also not learning about assets. Assets are very important. If marriage is a form of poverty insurance, so are assets. So is having a bank account. So is having a car. Having a car allows you to access far more employment opportunities than not having a car. So I think assets are an important avenue to explore when we're looking at poverty, and particularly intergenerational poverty. If we can teach the parents or the single mother how to deal with assets and managing a bank account and buying insurance and those kind of things, then the child is much more likely to have a greater sort of financial IQ when they grow up. And there is an interesting pilot project going on in this country right now. It doesn't get a lot of attention, but they've taken almost 5,000 low-income people in 10 cities around the country. 16% of them happen to be single mothers. And they've said they've put them in this program, and they give them some instructions, etc., and they set up these special bank accounts. And they say for every dollar that you put in this bank account, the program, and it varies by municipality, but they'll get $3 or $4 or $5 in that bank account. And it gives them the ability to manage something a little bit greater than what they would normally have done. It also gives them a big incentive. This money cannot be spent on beer or popcorn. It's locked in, and you can only take it out for schooling and self-employment. So it's society's interest in this money is protected. But society has an even bigger interest, I think, in if we're interested in low-income families and single-parent families and moving out of poverty, and particularly the intergenerational aspect to it, that as well as giving them more income, if we give them some sense of how to manage assets, I think that's a very important tool we can give them. And also, if we're encouraging work, we don't really care as a society how many assets they have. If we're giving welfare checks out, then we worry if you're driving around a Cadillac on my bill. But if we're pushing people into the workforce, then we don't care how many assets they've got. It's more is better. So that's I'm just going to recap here because I can never I cannot sum up things. I'm unable to do that. These are all our forks in the road. We started in the second half of the talk I decided for you that single-parent poverty was the main demographic we were going to be interested in. We looked at marital and fiscal solutions. I think marital solutions are very interesting. Unfortunately, I wanted to be able to give you some concrete information on things that I recommend, and it simply isn't there, particularly from the Bush administration's Healthy Marriages Initiative. So I had to spend most of my time on fiscal solutions. There you come to the fork. Should we make welfare rewarding? Should we make work rewarding? We talked about that quite a bit. I decided that work was a far more promising avenue for single-parent families. When we make that decision, then we're presented with the welfare wall. How do we scale? How do we get people over that wall? You can take non-market solutions, all that laundry list of things from minimum wage, higher minimum wage, and universal child care, etc. to market incentive, which is essentially something like the EITC, and that takes us down to income building. And then just as an adjunct, I wanted to talk about asset building, because even though it doesn't fit with the flow, I think it is interesting. So that brings me to the end. A lot of these solutions will apply to two-parent families as well as single-parent families, but I just, to frame the argument, I focus mostly on single-parent families. So this is the end of our fork-filled road. So if anyone wanted to make comments or discussion, I'm happy to hear. Yep.
Okay, in the first fork you looked at, well, actually it was before the first fork, it was the single-parent family, X amount of poverty, married families, X amount of poverty, and you admit that there's more poverty because this is a much bigger group, this married family group. Mm-hmm. I'm just going to put a question to you. Is it not more likely that if you had incentives for the married family to come out of poverty, that you'd find a lot less child poverty by looking at that opportunity than the single-parent family, especially since you discouraged the single-parent family by doing that?
Well, I mean, my solutions like the working income tax benefit, that does not discriminate between single-parent and two-parent family. It's going to benefit a two-parent family that faces a welfare wall just as much as a single-parent family does. So, I mean, these solutions are not, marriage-specific, I guess. And it is true that there's slightly more poor children in in two-parent families and single-parent families. I just you want to spend scarce resources in the most effective way possible. It seems to me that that led you to say, if we can, if a third of this demographic is in poverty, that might be the first place you start.
You asked why there wasn't a better name for these programs, WITB and EITC. I can tell you at finance, WITB is known as WITB.
Whitby,
which may have something to do with the fact that Jim Flaherty represents the town of Whitby. anyway, when he discovered it was called the Whitby, he was very enthusiastic. More importantly, though, I was going to point out something that people might be interested in about the EITC, which doesn't have such a nice way of pronouncing the acronym. But one of the interesting things about the EITC is it's an interesting example of soft paternalism, in the sense that the beneficiaries of EITC may take their money in one of two forms. They can either get it as a reduction in deductions off their paycheck. In other words, they can get it every 2 weeks in a small amount, or it can be banked up and they can get it as a single amount at the end of the year. The default position is a lump sum at the end of the year, and over 90% of EITC recipients prefer to get it that way. They've done extensive surveys of the recipients, and they have said even though they are aware that they could get it as a small amount every 2 weeks, they much prefer to get it as the lump sum because, to your asset accumulation point, they say it allows them to achieve a level of savings they wouldn't be able to do if they were getting small amounts every 2 weeks, because that just disappears in the ordinary transactions of life, whereas the large amount makes it possible for them to do things like buy a car or make a down payment on a house. And as a result, they have themselves decided that they want to get these lump sum payments rather than the every 2 weeks. And it seems to work out extremely well.
Well, it's interesting, because one of the few criticisms of the WITB by...
Whitby.
By like the Caledon Institute was the fact that it's not going to be run through provincial organizations. Saskatchewan has something like this, it's smaller, but they run it through their welfare system, and so the benefits go out monthly. And there's been some, academics kind of go back and forth, which is...
Well, I can tell you the American experience is the recipients themselves want a lump sum payment.
Can I just take up one of the points that was just raised, and I got a couple of other ones. I get this terrible feeling of deja vu here. I mean, we've been over this in the UK. I mean, it was imitate the earned income tax credit. We had a working families tax credit. If you go up this road to the work with the working families tax credit, the poverty lobby then said, oh, but what about the people out of work? So it was split, and the people out of work got the tax credit as well. there was always this pressure to increase the numbers. Once you're on means-tested welfare, there's always a pressure to increase the numbers. And anyway, even if you're in work and you're drawing this tax credit, it's still a subsidy, it's still welfare. And you can end up, if the person's getting the earned income tax credit, or with the one we had in the UK, or this other one, and they're getting childcare, you can end up spending far more on subsidies than they're actually earning, and in fact far more than they're subsidising them completely out of work. It's still a subsidy, and it's still got to be withdrawn at some point. And it's still, you know, so you're pushing the withdrawal rate up the income tax, up the income scale. It's got to go at some point. And then there's pressure again to extend it yet further up the income scale, because so the person's not losing so much. These things need to be infinitely extendable. And also, drawing on that last point, if you've got more in numbers of two-parent families in poverty, this is what we've had in the UK, the anti-poverty drive. We've ended up now not taking very many children out of poverty. In fact, poverty's starting to increase. And where's it increasing? Two-parent families who are in work, because they've been ignored, because the system is so orientated towards lone parents.
Well, I mean, this is a perfectly legitimate fork to come to. How do you spend your scarce resources? The question is, how can we help people in poverty right now? And you have to harness yourself to deal with those children. It just seems to me that single parent families are the most obvious and first place you would stop. It's kind of a triage system. Two-parent families have operate as a form of insurance. I've recommended here benefits single parent families over two parent families. I mean, the working income tax benefit is also to the benefit of two parent families that find themselves facing. I mean, I train as an economist. I believe in incentives and disincentives, and it seems to me that if you make welfare attractive, then people are going to stay there.
Same tax credit, same amount to a two-parent family and a one-parent family, the same original way. Because you've got two families on one family, one on the other, one on the other. So you're equalizing your rates of poverty by one scale, which you're handing out to the world without a difference. Per unit and then per number.
Well, I get back to the scarce resources issue, I guess. I think that that's where you can spend.
What's going to give you your best bang for your buck in your scarce resources?
Yeah.
And I would say the two-parent family, which is having a difficulty moving forward, is going to give you your best bang for your buck. They have the internal incentive of actually getting out of poverty in a much better way, and this is just a way of pushing forward. The single-parent family is always going to have the internal problem unless they get out of that situation being a single-parent family, because they're always the one person having raised children. They're always going to have a problem, no matter what, you know, whether it's child care, whether it's always going to be difficult.
Yeah, well, that's why I put up there the marital or fiscal solutions. I mean, the marital solution is attractive. I wanted to be able to bring some concrete evidence to here. And it seemed to me that if we're presented simply with the thought problem of single-parent families are in poverty, poverty is caused by low income, how can we solve that problem? That's the problem I'm trying to solve. The much broader perspective is how can we solve the issue of single parenthood in the country. But I'm saying, taken as given that we have these single parent families, how can we spend our resources best on them? But I think everything that I've suggested is applicable to a two parent family. I'm not discriminating in that way.
All right, Peter, we just wanted to thank you for your presentation and making data very colorful in those graphs. I appreciated that, so thank you. I'm just going to invite Dave Quist, our executive director, to come up and close us off here.
Well, thank you so much. I just want to take a moment to wrap up our day. It's a challenge.